America's Cannabis Conversation.
Good afternoon and welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. I'm Mark Corsi, CEO and co-founder of the W420 Radio Network. We would like to welcome you to the first of its kind radio program dedicated solely to the exciting and expanding world of cannabis. Our team has spent months creating a program that is dedicated to education, challenge, and promoting a healthy and lively dialogue regarding all things cannabis. Each Saturday at 4:20, our host, Dan Perkins, will lead the conversation and introduce you to a wide variety of guests and engage in thought-provoking discussions on topics from tips on growing to what's next in legalization. And a bonus to our listeners, we are proud to offer our first month commercial-free. So sit back and enjoy America's Cannabis Conversation, and thanks for tuning in. And now, let's start the conversation.
Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
Thank you, Patrick Combs, for that introduction. This is Dan Perkins, your host of America's Cannabis Conversation. I want to take a moment to tell you why we created this network and show. First and foremost, we wanted to educate as many people as possible about what is going on in the cannabis industry. You see, under federal statutes, those in the business of growing or selling cannabis products are forbidden to advertise on radio and TV, so they have a limited voice to tell their side of the story about cannabis. After a great deal of work, we found a way for those people in the cannabis business to have a voice, to tell the public why they're so excited about cannabis. You are listening today to the first virtual radio station in America that will broadcast every Saturday starting at 4:20 p.m. in your time zone solely about cannabis. The aired programs will be downloaded to our website, americascannabisconversation.com, so you can listen to them when you want. We will strive to make the shows informative, entertaining, and quick-paced. We will have industry experts, dispensary operators, investors, government officials, and more. We are breaking ground, and if you want to consider advertising one or more of our local channels in your neighborhood, your products and services, you can reach us through the website www.americascannabisconversation.com, and we can grow together. We want to hear from you about what you like or don't like about the show. So go to the website www.americascannabisconversation.com and tell us what you think. This is Dan Perkins. Hello, this is Dan Perkins, and this is your cannabis news in 2.5 minutes. In Washington, D.C., the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, launched a criminal investigation into the vaping health crisis, bringing added scrutiny to the legal marijuana industry and potentially exposing companies to federal legal action. Albuquerque, New Mexico, the Department of Health for the state of New Mexico, has asked a state judge to reconsider a ruling that must allow non-residents to participate in the medical cannabis program. State attorneys say allowing non-residents to participate would encourage the illegal transportation of cannabis across state lines. Fall River, Massachusetts. Two men who authorities alleged extorted money on behalf of the mayor of Fall River, Massachusetts, from companies seeking to obtain state licenses to operate cannabis retail businesses, have pleaded guilty. At least four marijuana business owners said they paid a total of $600,000 in bribes. Chicago, Illinois. Chicago's mayor wants the city to ban recreational marijuana stores in the Central Business District, a move that could hurt sales downtown. The mayor is finding significant opposition. Alderman Brendan Riley, who represents the business district in the city council, said because of the $838 million budget gap for Chicago, they can't afford to declare the Central Business District off limits. Las Vegas, Nevada. Nevada regulators launched an investigation into cannabis testing labs after tainted marijuana batches triggered two health advisories. The Department of Taxation started an investigation and discovered that the doctored THC levels by cannabis laboratories and products also had high levels of yeast and mold, in the products. Officials say that products from the same cultivators were tainted and discovered on shelves sold between July 10th and August 28th. And our last story is from Sacramento, California. Police are investigating a rash of cannabis retail robberies in the California capital. Recently, 10 break-ins took place at local marijuana dispensaries. Such robberies apparently have been escalating, according to Sacramento authorities. Robberies have always been a problem for the marijuana retailers, many of which operate on a cash-only basis because of lack of banking. One robber was so blatant that he drove his car, a stolen car, through the front door of the dispensary to get in. This has been your 2.5-minute cannabis news update. I'm Dan Perkins.
Welcome to our inaugural show, and we're having as our first guest a gentleman that I've had an opportunity to spend quite a few times talking to over the last month or so, Justin Karapathian, and he is a dynamic individual, very much involved in the cannabis industry. And the first thing I want to do is I want people to understand how you made the decision to get into the cannabis business. I think it's a wonderful story and shows great determination. So can you please spend a few moments telling us, Justin, how you came to this amazing industry?
You know, the laws of the universe or God or Jah, however you recognize higher powers, I think definitely play a role. But Dan, you know, you said something very unique is how did I come into the industry? And you kind of hit the nail in the head with that statement is that the industry kind of chose me. And I think it chooses people, especially that's the uniqueness about cannabis. And the story that I had for you, you know, it's very personal, but it was a very trial and turbulent type of a scenario in my life. And cannabis was very euphoric and exciting opportunity that was presented to me through some amazing godly event and has driven me to be not only very excited about what I do, but very excited about life. And I'll be happy to go into more detail, but definitely I would say that the industry has chosen a unique group of people, including myself. And that choice was coming from whether it was desperation, desire, ambition, need, greed, whatever it may be, definitely has transformed into being a very opportunity fulfilling and definitely a spiritual fulfilling.
You were, as I recall our discussions, Justin, you were in the retail business, and because of the Great Recession in 2008-09, it really changed your life. But you have taken that opportunity that came to you in 2008 or 2009, and I'm not trying to embarrass you. You've built a very significant, multifaceted business around this cannabis situation. And I'm amazed at the things that you've done, and I'm still learning. I don't know them all. But can you give us one of the things we talk about is the people I think they want to get in the cannabis business. And one of the reasons why I wanted you on the show, among many, is that I wanted you to speak to the challenges when you started and got involved with your first dispensary. What was it like? What were the frustrations, the trials and tribulations that you went through to launch yourself into a multifaceted, very, very successful career?
A very good question, Dan. The trials and tribulations in 2007, 2008, owning a dispensary was very, very difficult to deal with because you had one issue was the local police department. Then you had the federal government. That was another issue. So constantly you were living in an environment of fear. From the minute you woke up to the second you went to sleep, there was fear that was behind every move. Imagine waking up in the morning and engaging in an activity that you don't know what the result could be. And you knew that the worst result would be prison time. You knew that there was another level of a bad result, which could have been life, because at the time there was no laws or regulations around catering to the industry itself. So definitely, you know, waking up in the morning and engaging in an industry or business that there was so much uncertainty from a local level to a federal level, and even with family. I mean, you were, frowned upon because at that time it was still looked upon as you're a drug dealer. And whether you were doing it inside of a retail environment or whether you were just engaging in the industry, you know, I come from a very settled religious family, and they were very unhappy that I was engaging in such activities. At the time, it was frowned upon. And, unfortunately, I had lost my grandmother earlier in those years, in 2008, 2009, and I lost her to diabetes. And I remember my grandmother being a very religious woman. And if the doctor said that, take these pills, they'll be good for you, take these opiates, they'll be fine, but the doctor would never suggest any type of alternative type of medication or any alternative holistic methods. And when my grandma passed, I really had this other sense of passion to continue on, because I knew that if my grandmother was to obtain any cannabis products, it could have helped her with the blood pressure, with her diabetes scenarios that she was going through, with her appetite. And I really had this other sense of passion due to my grandmother's loss to also stick to it. But definitely, you dealt with local organized crimes, you dealt with gangbangers, shock callers, then you dealt with police, then you dealt with federal officers, undercover DEA agents. And when I say dealt with, I know I'm speaking a little bit comfortably, but maintained to try to at least conduct business in a proper manner, to be as diligent and compliant as possible, to not fall into the hands of these authorities that for some weird reason were enforcing laws that were archaic. So definitely a very unique environment. And you know, your successes, you can't gloat about it. You can't feel good about your successes, because the more achievements and the more accomplishments you had, the bigger of a target you became. So very an unorthodox environment for an entrepreneur or businessman who wants to better themselves, only to realize that every level of success is also a level of danger that they're potentially engaging in. So not your typical industry, I would say.
Yeah. We're talking with Justin Carapaton, a very successful entrepreneur in the cannabis space. When did you turn the corner? When did you say, you had to stop looking over your shoulder and to wake up every morning of fear of the law? When did that change?
I would probably say about never. Never. You know, that's a very good question. You ask very good questions. I got to give it to you, because that comfortability, let's just say my shell has opened up a little bit more in the last 12 to 24 months. As California regulation adopted and voted in the adult use in 2016, which was enacted in 2018 of January, I became a little bit more open and a little bit more outlandish in a sense of what I'm doing and how much I'm involved in the cannabis industry, to bring some sense of best practices and good operation maneuvers in the industry, to progress the industry, to grow the industry. But that fear is still here. I mean, at the end of the day, if you think about it, we're still a Schedule I narcotic. And in federal court, there is no legitimate defense, whether it's medical or adult use. And there is no state protection or state provisional protection for any type of activity within that criteria. So it's almost as if we're in a big herd, and you're just hoping that if the lion is after you, you're not the one being trampled on or eaten or caught, for that matter. So mm-hmm. that fear, still, I think, looms around the industry. But definitely, as you see the progression of competitors and the progression of the industry, and you look at the media, you look at the Canadian stock exchanges, and you see the big evolution in what's happening with cannabis, it gives you a little bit of sense of, hey, everything is okay, we can continue to move forward. But in reality, the scope of the dangers are practically still the same, minus some nuances such as local enforcement that have approved and adopted ordinances that allow this business to conduct in a commercial level.
So if I listened to what you said, and I've been to all of your websites, and I think I've posted all of your websites. What you're really saying, at least is my interpretation, Justin, and we're speaking with Justin Carapaton from California about his success in the marijuana and cannabis industry. You use terms that are typically sound like a business person looking at how to run your business. And if I look at all the things that you've done as a business, you've been extremely successful by diversifying your business, not so much in cannabis, but providing, looking at other products and services that not only you, but people in your industry could use. And where did that come about?
Dan, that comes from understanding that industries change. I've been in a leather garment business. My father was originally in a leather industry. We cater to biker groups and members, and as well as clubs. And we did a lot of their fittings and outfittings for their club members and prospects and any apparels that pertain to leather. And I saw that industry in 2008, 2007, literally get decimated over a 6-month to a 12-month course. And when I felt that back then, I realized that there's a uniqueness to being diversified. There's a uniqueness to having different parts of an industry so you can always mull over to whichever part of the industry is whether lacking, hurting, or succeeding. And typically, I think having that leverage and option to be able to conduct a business in within the industry, but still be able to maneuver around so it can at least, you can go to the favorable side of where the industry's best values are being adopted or created. And for us, our motto for our company that we live by is vertically integrated and horizontally diversified. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that we are not just vertically integrated cannabis company, we're also horizontally diversified. We're very large product producers. So if the industry was a little bit going through hardships, such as the retail division right now, under the 280E federal law, you cannot write off any of your general expenses. It is literally one of the horrible places to be in the cannabis industry is retail. And a lot of people don't know that. A lot of people think retail is the place to go. It's the last mile where you see the customer or you see the patients, whichever type of a facility you operate. But at the end of the day, considering the federal taxing rules under 280E, the retail side is a very difficult position to be in. But being horizontally diversified, meaning that, okay, if I don't see the retail side being a very successful or easy adoption area for our business to excel in or to scale in, then we are very unique at producing products or manufacturing or cultivating. So that is the uniqueness of being diversified in such an industry that is changing literally week by month.
Hmm. Well, we're going to have to pause for just a moment. So we'll be back with Justin right after this break.
America's Cannabis Conversation.
Well, we're back with Justin talking about business, and I want to move on to talk about what Justin sees ahead for the industry that he's in. What does cannabis look like as a business model for you going forward?
Very exciting in all levels. I mean, you're talking prohibition all over again in 2019. I mean, here we are, 2020, and you're seeing something that happened many, many, many years ago. Imagine having an opportunity nowadays where you can create your own Coors. You can create your own Pepsi. You can create a brand that is as extravagant as Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson. There has not been a commodity opportunity for decades, and right now what's happening with cannabis is it's a new commodity that is being introduced to the marketplace. It's been around, but it's definitely becoming new in a sense of that it's adopting regulatory rules and it's engaging in development of products, and now you're getting a lot of talent that is coming in that is able to produce and develop and create IPs And it's just all around the industry, whether you're a grower, manufacturer, distributor, dispensary owner, delivery guy, whatever it is, even to the core of real estate entitlements, there is an amazing movement that is just greatly moving ahead at a fast pace. And we call it pot time. And pot time basically is 1 month of cannabis time is worth a year of regular time. And that's how fast the industry is evolving. And it's just exciting to be a part of it.
Yeah, I saw recently that the estimated growth rate, and this is only, you know, a month into the second quarter, they're thinking that sales are going to be up 35%. But I want to go back to something you said about prohibition, because I think I'm right on this. I think I did this research. When we had a prohibition law illegal in this country with a constitutional amendment, prior to doing that, marijuana and cannabis were not illegal. They were perfectly legal, and they were brought in prohibition. But when we got rid of prohibition, we got rid of the prohibition on restrictions of sale of alcohol, but they left the prohibitions in on cannabis and marijuana. And it's taken all that time to this point where we're beginning to see some significant movement. And I think the analogy that you talk about as a commodity, it's interesting. When you think in terms of commodities, you think of nondescript. But where I wanted to go next was you're part of the next evolution in the business that's looking to brand particular products and looking for selling that brand across multiple distributions. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is one component of our company, yes.
Is branding going to be the biggest part of the business, having established brands like you mentioned, Pepsi and Coke and Miller and all those brands for commodity products? Branding is going to be even more important.
You know, if you look at where we're at today, when you're walking through a store, when you're walking through even an e-commerce site, and you can truly see the value in developing a brand that is trusted, that is consistent, that is quality, and that brand nowadays is marked in people's genetics, where when you're walking down the store, by just the talent of some of these marketing, branding, and intellectual property groups is just amazing, where they've embedded this comfort in attaching a person, their personality to a brand, and adopting that and introducing it now into the cannabis industry in its earlier years will profoundly give you a head game above everybody else who enters the sector many years to come ahead. So definitely branding is a 10-year play, I believe. People who are branding now will feel the profound effects of that 3 to 5 years down the line. As some of these brands start to gain traction, start to gain followers, start to build their own community, and whether it's a CBD product, it's a THC product, branding, I think, is going to have to start playing a role, because we've never had that opportunity. Nobody's ever walked in a store recently, really, that believes in a true trusted brand. I mean, there are these brands that exist on the shelves now, but it's just so new. There hasn't been a chance for people to adopt it, to understand it, or to fall in love with it, or even to be convinced that this is their brand or go-to brand. And to have that opportunity and that platform that's so wide open right now is a very unique opportunity for people like myself, as well as people in the industry.
We're speaking with Justin Karapetian, and we're trying to gain from his wealth of knowledge and experience about his time in the cannabis industry. Let me, if I could, extend the brand question just a little bit. It seems to me that one of the things that's radically changed in the last few years is some of those major brands that you've talked about, Coca-Cola, Miller, Budweiser, and others, along with Philip Morris and the other tobacco companies, are acquiring interest in growers because they're looking at infusions of bringing, if you would, a cannabis-infused Coca-Cola or beer or wine or whatever. Is that going to be a significant growth opportunity?
Absolutely. I mean, anytime you got these big Fortune 500 companies that are starting to look at this industry and not even look at it or physically and financially getting involved, they're definitely planning for what's coming around the corner. And I think at the end of the day, if you look at Consolidation Brands and some of these other groups that are uniquely pushing and investing, whether it's in Canada or here, some of the alcohol companies are heavily investing right now in cannabis. It's market share. And you're having a lot of people that are converting from whether using opiates or whether using alcohol or whether using other drugs are really converting over into cannabis. Cannabis is, in a way, becoming a very therapeutic way of kind of relieving yourself away from other opiates or any other addiction. So cannabis, you know, they used to say that cannabis then was a gateway drug. I still till this day believe that cannabis is the gatekeeper drug. I think it's the one that doesn't make you go to hardcore stuff. I think it's the drug, if you want to consider it a drug, I think it's the gatekeeper of you not having other addictions such as alcohol, opiates, or any other really intense hardcore drugs that are out there on the streets. But that's the uniqueness of cannabis and the holistic value that I think it brings. And a lot of people who are using it that were alcoholic or did have drug addictions are really realizing that, wow, I'm able to function on this. It satisfies me. It really gets me to think in a unique manner. And the imagination space, you know, station, I say, always explodes when you're on cannabis. It's very unique plant. And your body recognizes it as a vegetable. So it's very much safer than most other things out there. And I think that there's definitely on the corporate level, some of these companies are realizing that if they don't get in and don't establish themselves with the industry somehow and at least understanding it, I think they're going to take it to another level. When, you know, some, if you think of Philip Morris or if you think of Johnson & Johnson, if you think of some of these R.J. Reynolds, if some of these other large organizations get into it, they're the ones that I believe are going to take it to the next level where we're really going to see true dosing of cannabis products, measured micro dosing of cannabis products, as well as a wide range of new unique developed SKUs and products that are going to be coming out in the marketplace. So on that question, I think they're not only looking at getting involved, they are indirectly, but do remember there is the federal tension. There is still a Schedule One issue that is facing the industry. And I think that's what's really kept some of these large organizations kind of on the sidelines, you know, just dipping their toes in, whether it's consultants or various other financial officers in their organization that are definitely getting involved to truly understand the industry before they sink their fingers in.
Right. We have been talking to Justin Karapathian about his experience in building a very successful cannabis business. And unfortunately, Justin, for this segment, we're out of time. We want to have you back on the show again. I know you've got a bunch of websites, but is there anything, any particular website that you'd like to have people look to understand your company? What would it be?
Absolutely. www.colas.com. www.colas.com will give an idea about the retail brand that we have launched, which is basically an Apple meets a Starbucks. And www.ccmup.com. That's ccmup.com. And that's a little bit on the management side and various operational services that we provide and do.
So thank you so much for joining us today, Justin, and we'll look forward to having you on again real soon.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Very excited, Dan.
Let's listen as Dan introduces us to his next guest.
Welcome to the conversation, and joining us today is a gentleman that I've had an opportunity to talk with a couple of times. His name is Morgan Fox, and he's a legislative representative, if that's the right term, Morgan, for the National Cannabis Industry Association. Good afternoon and welcome to the conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. And I'm actually the media relations director, but I work very closely with our government relations team here in D.C.
Okay, so that's terrific. Thank you so much. We're going to talk about a couple of current events. We're going to focus this week on specifically the SAFE banking bill that was passed by the House. Now, there's a lot of people probably listening to this program who, if they're dispensary owners or growers, know what the problem is as far as banking. But I think perhaps a lot of the general public has no idea of what's going on. So, Morgan, if you would just take a moment and help educate the audience about why this SAFE banking bill is important.
Absolutely. So under current federal regulations, it is very, very difficult for banks to be able to do business with cannabis industry businesses, as well as ancillary businesses. There is a requirement for extremely strenuous reporting for any transaction that involves cannabis in any way, shape, or form, even if there are several degrees of separation in it. There are pretty significant legal threats against banks that do business with cannabis businesses, both from Department of Justice and Department of the Treasury, that while currently are not being strenuously enforced because of the current Department of Justice policy, are still a threat that most banks aren't willing to take the risk on. There are also reputational risks involved, but the bottom line is that the vast majority of financial institutions are completely unwilling to do any sort of business with the cannabis industry in any way. And this creates a lot of problems. First, that most businesses are forced to operate entirely in cash, which creates a huge public safety problem, not only for the businesses themselves, but for employees who have to be paid in cash, and for tax collectors and other people that are working with those businesses that also have to be paid in cash. To the point where we've seen tax collection offices in several states have stage walkouts because they didn't feel safe having that amount of cash on hand in a non-secured location. You know, there are also a lot of other problems that trickle down to the employees, such as having their personal bank accounts closed because they work in the cannabis industry, which makes it very difficult to get a mortgage or lease an apartment or get a car. All of these things are real detriments to people being able to live normal lives simply because they work in the cannabis industry. This also creates problems with transparency, so it makes it harder for state regulators to be able to accurately determine what is going on in their state financially in this industry. It makes it more difficult for law enforcement to be able to have any sort of oversight and make sure that there are no criminal elements trying to infiltrate legal businesses. I think finally, and perhaps most importantly, it creates a real problem for small businesses and particularly people from marginalized communities who don't have the same sort of access to deep financial networks and angel investors that a lot of other people do. And this means that they've basically been shut out of the industry, or it's very, very difficult for them to sustain themselves in this industry without access to traditional bank lending, which banks are unwilling to do under the current federal regulations.
Morgan, on this program, we're going to have some stories about some recent events, and one recent event took place in Sacramento, California, where over a weekend, 10 dispensaries were broken into, and hundreds of thousands of dollars of cash, including safes with unknown amount of money in them and products, were stolen, and one so blatantly as to drive a car, stolen car, crash through the front door to gain access. The cash is a, as you pointed out, a very important issue. And so how does this House bill impact that problem?
Well, the Safe Banking Act basically provides safe harbor for financial institutions that wish to work with the cannabis industry to be able to do so without fear of federal interference or prosecution. And with the idea being that this will provide the assurances that banks, credit card companies, credit unions, and other financial services businesses would need to be able to offer services to the cannabis industry. And, you know, so far we've been seeing a lot of positive momentum. As you mentioned, just last week, the bill, which happened to be the first standalone cannabis legislation to ever get a vote in the House of Representatives, won by an overwhelming bipartisan margin. It was 321 votes out of 435 members of Congress. And that's just huge, especially considering that it's the first cannabis bill to come up for a vote. But we think that this also will help us provide a lot of momentum in the Senate, where there's currently Republican control, given how many Republicans in the House voted for this bill, and the fact that it also covers things like hemp and CBD businesses, which the speaker, the Senate Majority Leader is very, very focused on right now.
We're speaking with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association, and he is their communications director and sometimes works with the lobbying operation of the organization. So McConnell said that he, because Kentucky, I guess, is now a booming hemp-growing state, that he might be predisposed to bringing this to a vote, or am I reading the wrong tea leaves here?
Well, that's really one of the things that we're trying to promote when it comes to our Senate lobbying efforts. We've already seen relatively unexpected interest from the head of the Senate Banking Committee, Senator Mike Crapo from Idaho, and he has made several statements in the very recent past that he's working very hard with the Senate Banking Committee and other stakeholders and co-sponsors of the existing Senate version of the bill to try to push this through committee and hopefully get a vote. Whether or not Senator McConnell will actually allow it to come to a vote in the full Senate is something that we haven't quite determined yet. But the fact that the Safe Banking Act would also protect hemp farmers in his constituency, which he has been publicly lauding for months now, if not longer, I think is definitely a good motivator to get him to come to the table.
We're speaking with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association, and we've got just a couple of minutes, and I wanted to have you help me look down the road a little bit. So let's suppose that this legislation, and we haven't talked about whether or not the Senate has a different version or will they take a vote on the House version, but let's suppose that it passes the House and the Senate and the president signs the bill. How soon can it be implemented?
Well, I think that it would be implemented almost immediately. I'm not sure about the exact timing, but I believe that the restrictions on banks would disappear almost immediately. And I know that the American Bankers Association, the Credit Union National Association, and a number of other financial services groups are champing at the bit to be able to promote this market to their members. And I think that we will see very, very quickly a large number of small to medium-sized banks start to work with the cannabis industry very quickly. I think that perhaps some of the larger banks might take a little bit more convincing and might need cannabis to be completely descheduled before they're willing to work in the industry. But it would definitely alleviate a huge percentage of the problems regarding banking that the cannabis industry is currently facing.
It appears to me that there just looking at the numbers, $11.5 billion in sales last year legally, somewhere projecting around $18 billion this year, and maybe $25 billion by 2021 or 2022. If it continues, the staggering amount of cash on the sidelines is putting more and more people in jeopardy.
Absolutely. I mean, it makes zero sense to have such a robust and expanding industry have no access to financial services whatsoever. And if we really want to make sure that this industry is truly equitable and diverse, we need to make sure that we open up access to capital as soon as possible.
Morgan, I got one more quick question because we just got a little over a minute left. The question really deals with, you kind of touched on implementation, but the other part of the puzzle here is not only is there a banking issue, there's a problem of IRS and a deductibility of operating expenses for dispensaries and places like that. Would you see that changing as part of the banking bill, or is that another battle you have to fight?
That would not be affected by the Safe Banking Act, but it's something that NCIA and a number of other groups are working very hard on. It's possible that that will be dealt with through standalone legislation or as part of a larger bill to deschedule cannabis, which would include that automatically because it would no longer be subject to the 280E tax code that prevents businesses from deducting expenses on their federal taxes.
Good. We've been talking with Morgan Fox. He is the communications director for the National Cannabis Industry Association. And Morgan, if people want to follow you or find out more information about your association, where do they go?
Our website is thecannabisindustry.org, and we're also available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking to you. We look forward to talking to you again. This was Morgan Fox from MCIA. We'll be right back after these messages.
Now let's continue the conversation with Dan and his guest.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an incredibly important guest with us, Mike.
Yeah, it's a mouthful. That's why everybody calls me Big Mike, because it's a lot easier to say than my last name.
I appreciate that, and I thank you. And I want to know where Big Mike came from. But it's important for our audience to understand that you are one of the pioneers. You're one of the people in this country who was a spearhead behind the evolution of the cannabis industry in the United States. And everybody that I talk to knows Big Mike. And so I have to ask you, Big Mike, first of all, where did Big Mike come from?
Well, I was born in, my father was Latvian. My mother was Estonian. They've since passed away. I have Estonian citizenship. However, I was born in Portland, Oregon, raised in good old America, grew up in the Midwest, and went to California, then went to Canada for about 9 years and came back to the States, and here I am.
And why do they call you Big Mike?
Because I'm 6'7".
Whoa! I guess
you are a big guy. Yeah, kind of stuck. Yeah.
So tell us about your start in the cannabis business in the United States. How did it happen?
Wow, I started out 36 years ago in a town called Aurora, Illinois. I had my first indoor grow, and I was 23 years old, and I've been growing ever since. And then I kind of risk mitigated myself by saying, okay, I want to grow a lot of cannabis. Where in the world can I grow and grow a lot of cannabis and not have to worry about doing a lot of time and all this kind of stuff? And, it was Canada. So I went to Canada, and I started growing, you know, bigger places and bigger operations. And then I was never happy with the nutrients that were being used for cannabis because they weren't specifically made for cannabis. The laws were changing in Canada that allowed for medical marijuana usage at the federal level. And so I got together with UBC University. BC Research was their research arm, and BCIT, which is like the MIT of Canada. And together they had two different licenses that, when combined, would allow me to study cannabis. And so I started studying cannabis and found out, I tested roots, leaves, stalks, buds, through all phases of growth, multiple different strains, and figured out what cannabis likes to eat on, I suppose. And then as the research went on, you know, years and years later, I want to preface this first. I had a lawn care company called Turf Pro when I was 19 years old, where it was my own business, and I mixed these tanks full of chemicals and sprayed them on people's lawns and made them green and all this stuff. So I like to say I've been in the grass business since I've been 19 years of age. And I grew up as a farm kid. Yeah, I grew up as like a country kid in Batavia, Illinois. So I worked on farms, and I've always liked to, you know, earth and plants and all this stuff. And so I knew science always holds the answers. It holds the truth. And so I went to science. And then from there, I you know, started studying with other scientists around the world, going to these seminars that they have, you know, 150 to 200 of the top plant researchers who are on the cutting edge of research, met every year. And so I decided to go one year. I actually wasn't invited, but I went in anyways. And I made friends with everybody. And so they put me on the roster. And every year I would go and I would talk to all these guys. And I would learn what the cutting edge about plant growth was. Plus, I lived in the research library at UBC University, studying all the different aspects of how to manipulate plants. I put that knowledge and a lot of testing into advanced nutrients. And so then I heard Bulgarian Academy of Science was laying off some of their top scientists. And I went and I talked to them. I said, do you think we can get a license to study cannabis here in Bulgaria? And the lead scientist said, absolutely, I know how to do that. And they would be very, you know, interested in supplying a license for us. We had to go through six ministries. So, you know, I've got 25 PhDs for the last 15 years that have been studying cannabis and cannabinoid and terpenoid research at a very, very serious level. And so that research led me to keep improving the products to where they are today. And it's the number one, you know, cannabis fertilizer brand in the world. We're in 103 countries and do over 100 million a year. And now we're getting big into, I'm starting another company called Advanced Hemp that will have genetics and also a fertilizer system and products to optimize CBD production in hemp.
When you started growing it in Canada, and mm-hmm. did you decide to open up a storefront?
I've been in all aspects of the hydroponic business, which basically serves the cannabis industry, manufacturing equipment, importing equipment from around the world, and had a distribution. I had a hydroponic store, which is a storefront, but I wasn't actually selling cannabis. But however, I will say, we did open a dispensary, and we had it open for about 3 months, and they closed us down in Vancouver. This was just while they were just allowing some medical marijuana dispensaries to happen, but we had lines around the block, and this attracted too much attention, and the guys were doing the paperwork right and everything, but they decided to close us down anyways. So
did you ever reopen?
That was my first run-in, I guess.
Did you ever reopen?
No, we didn't reopen. It wasn't like what they're doing here, what they did in California, back in the, 10 years ago here. No, it wasn't like that. It was a little bit different up there.
It must have been an amazing experience to decide to sell, to open your doors, to sell product that you were growing. And as you said, people around the block, that must have been enormously rewarding, both financially and emotionally for you.
Oh,
but,
it, yeah,
but
sure.
The downer when
validation at a young age like that is really, it's nice to feel that and to see that people like what you're doing. And, the product was grown with Advanced Nutrients, which is my fertilizer, cannabis fertilizer company. And the products just took off because, we never hid behind tomatoes. We always said that we're for cannabis. We were outspoken about it. We always pushed the edge of the envelope. And we're advocates of medical marijuana. When I first started, I was 23 years old. I was doing it to generate revenue. And then Jack Herrera read his book, and met him on Venice Beach while he was still alive, and started talking about cannabis and all the things that it can do. And I had a different take on the plant. And I remember in '97, my brother and I were trimming weed together, and he looked at me. He goes, "Do you think this will ever be legal?" And I said, "Absolutely." I said, "I don't know when it's going to happen, but I would say probably within 20 years or so, or maybe even more, that this thing will be a 100% legal industry." And now here we are, a little longer than that, but pretty close to it, and it's sweeping the world.
So we're talking to Big Mike, and is it Advanced Nutrients is the name of your company? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah, and he's created a phenomenal fertilizer for growing marijuana. So I'm curious, so you were in Canada for 6 years, and then you came back to the States?
Yeah, 9 years. 9 years.
Nine years, excuse me.
Yep,
9 years. Why did you come back?
Because I realized that the cannabis was growing fast here in the U.S., and the U.S. would be the financial driving force globally behind cannabis eventually. And I came to LA because this is where media and marijuana, this is the intersection. And, some of the best, writers and video people here and storytellers are here in the LA area. So I figured it was a really good place. And by the way, this is ground zero for marijuana innovation and technologies right now.
So you came to Los Angeles, and did you start a dispensary? You started growing? What did you do?
I had Advanced Nutrients, and so I've been selling the nutrient. And it's not just fertilizer; it's a complete system of about. We have 30 different products that manipulate cannabis and take it to its true genetic potential, and every step of the way. So, we manipulate the plant in vegetative growth, and then through the three different cycles in the bloom phase, all the way from what we call seed to senescence, we have products that optimize that plant's true potential.
We are talking with Big Mike, who is a founder of the U.S. cannabis and now with his Advanced Nutrients company supplying nutrients to companies all over the world. Big Mike, in our last segment, you were talking about Advanced Nutrients and being in California. And how has your business grown over that? When was it that you came to California?
I was living in Bulgaria for about 3 years because that's where my science team was, and I was going back and forth, and this whole thing was catching on, and I realized I had to be here full time. And since it's not just the the fertilizer products anymore. I've got what's a company called Big Mike's Blends and Lacturtis Labs, where we do cannabis research, and we have a line of pre-rolls and vape pens. The pre-rolls are already out. They're all outcome-based. We have 7 different outcomes. A lot of people are selling strains, and, you know, strains are great because that's, we came out of a grower-centric community, and growers care about strains. Patients care about outcomes. They want less pain. They want better sleep, you know, stimulate their appetite, you know, better sex, and everything in between. You can manipulate the different cannabinoids and terpenoids and different chemical profiles of that plant. The future of cannabis is really going to be a recombinant product. So whether you're in London or Tokyo or Los Angeles, that product's going to be exactly the same. And to do that, you have to be able to separate out the different constituents that make up the 529 chemicals that make up cannabis and then recombine them in a lab environment to make, or heavy metals, and that is absolutely safe for the patient to use, because the way I look at it, everybody who uses some form of cannabis or another is a patient, because they're trying to relieve something or take their stress away or anxiety.
Big Mike, and one of the challenges I think for the cannabis industry is that they've gotten a bad rap, but you did so well in just a moment ago when you were talking about standardization and process. And I think there are a lot of people, probably not properly informed, but a lot of people who think that there's no consistency to product, there aren't any measurement standards, and you never know whether you're going to get too much or not enough. And so what's happening in terms of standardization?
Well, Dan, that's a great question, because now with the laws in place from state to state, the product that people are putting out on the marketplace is being laboratory tested and checked out. And you're exactly right. You know, 40 to 50 years of propaganda that we've had, negative propaganda, has you know, filled up people's minds with a lot of stuff. And even, you know, I'm at ground zero here, so it's kind of a different culture. But when you get outside, I call it the bubble, into other parts of the world and America, there's still a lot of that stigma still attached in people's minds. Until they actually use it, or a family member gets sick and uses it, and or a pet, and they see that it actually, you know, that they were lied to for the last 40 or 50 years, it's a huge game changer. And education is the number one paramount thing that this entire community industry still has to push out, because you're exactly right. People, you know, don't really understand what the potential of this plant is.
So they're making decisions based on rumors and innuendos as opposed to facts.
Yeah.
And
so like the industry, madness. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, maybe the industry needs to focus on getting more of the facts out. I don't know how they do that, but maybe that's you know, it's interesting here in Florida where I live. I went to visit a dispensary because I was looking for one of the doctors to be on the show. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how the business has changed, and he said when we first started, before we opened the doors, we had a business model that we thought that we're going to have, our customers are going to be between 18 and 30. And
no way.
3 years later, it's not 18 to 30, it's over 45.
You're correct, Dan. Look, the average age of a new patient, medical patient that walks into a dispensary is 56 years of age. And by the way, they spend 3 times more on a monthly basis than the recreational users, or adult use, as they call it now, will spend. And yeah, it's skewing to an older demographic. Because one of the biggest things about a cannabis, if you get the right combination or the right strain, is pain relief and reduce anxiety. You know, a lot of people would come home and have a drink or you know, or have a beer or have a shot or whatever. Now people come home and, you know, they medicate with cannabis. And it's not just smoking either. There's edibles, there's tinctures, there's creams you can put on. It's every form, you know, possible, as well as pets. But yeah, it's skews to an older demographic right now.
We're talking with Big Mike about his life experience in the cannabis, and as a scientist and as an inventor and a true mentor for lots of people, and a founder of this business. Mike, let's talk about where do you see this industry going?
Wow. Well, right now there's a lot of people getting into the industry. There's probably, it'd be safe to say, 20,000 brands probably out there right now across America, and there's going to be a consolidation like in any business. What I see going on right now is companies who are in the business who have very deep pockets are going negative to acquire patients and clients. And the guys who've got 10 million, 20 million, 30 million, if they're not careful, they're going to burn through their cash before they get, before I'd say the battle ends, right? And right now there's blood in the streets. And even in my own case, I have a lab and all this, it's better for me to outsource to vendors because they're willing to go negative to do business. And that's kind of the business model that I'm doing right now. I'm outsourcing. I have a license. I have every license that you can have in the state of California, yet I'm outsourcing to different vendors who are willing to go negative, and that way I can turn a profit and keep going while I, you know, this big war is going on to, you know, get as many patients as they possibly can. But here's the thing. They don't understand the lifetime value of a patient or what are they going to be using in the future. All they know, they're just going out there, and it's basically kind of like it's buying hysteria right now. There is hyper valuations going on in this industry that are just through the roof. People have asked me, well, how come you haven't gone, you know, public yet? Because it's just a lot of fluff and air right now. The dust hasn't even settled. You have a bunch of folks all over the country selling CBD and like crazy, but what they're not realizing is even if the state laws say that you can do that and we can do that on a federal level, the FDA has not come out with their guidelines yet, and the USDA has not come out with their guidelines. And it's going to be very interesting to see what they come out and how they do this and how they're going to limit a lot of these folks who are in the business right now, and a lot of people who are selling CBD who don't even have a cannabis license. And this means that those folks aren't under any regulation for testing. So there's a lot of CBD products out there, and in some areas up to 70% of the products are just false products. They're just, there's not even any hemp-derived products in there. And everyone is on this hemp-derived CBD bandwagon or CBD bandwagon. You have to be really, really careful from who you're buying it from. Make sure that they're licensed in the state and there's testing in place and the products are tested. Otherwise, you don't know what you're getting. And that's right. Why the FDA is going to get involved right. And the USDA is getting involved.
Can I go back and ask you a question about something you just said, please? You said go negative. What do you mean there?
Oh, okay. So you know what? There's a break-even point to go sell a product in the marketplace, right? And so they're willing to lose money. In other words, if a product costs $4, they're willing to sell it to you for $3. And every time that they sell that product, they're losing a dollar, but they don't care because to them, they're gaining market share. However, because this war of attrition is going on right now, a lot of these companies who are fighting it out with each other and are going negative, they don't understand the cost of goods, or they haven't figured it out, or they do and they don't care. They have hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. They're willing to lose money on every patient they acquire for, you know, God knows how long. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this thing plays out.
Fascinating discussion, and I just think you're a wealth of knowledge, and I'm honored and a privilege to have you on. How can people find out about your growing medium?
Well, you can go to advancednutrients.com and check that out. If you want to see our line of cannabis products, you can go to at Big Mike's Blends, or go to my Instagram, which is at Big Mike. I do a lot of teaching as well on my Instagram.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you for joining the conversation today, and we hope that you will join us in the coming weeks. Here are just a few of the guests joining the conversation. A Harvard researcher studying the impact of cannabis on pancreatic cancer, and he's getting ready to start an FDA study. An entrepreneur who his whole family started a CBD products manufacturing and distribution company. A power engineer who helps potential growers figure out how much power they will need to run their grow houses. You will be surprised at how much power is really needed. A man who designed and built trimming machines for cannabis, and he eliminates hand trimmers and pays for itself in months, not years. An investment analyst will help you make sense out of investing in cannabis stocks. A British pharmacist who has a 12-point checklist that for you to go over before you buy CBD products. So go to our website, www.americascannabisconversation.com, and you can see who's coming on next week and in future weeks. Keep coming back, finding more information. These and many more interesting conversations are coming up on America's Cannabis Conversation for you. This is Dan Perkins. Come join us next week.